Hey, everybody, listening to the Writer's Process Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I've got an awesome guest today. Here from California, where I'm at as well. Please welcome Houston Howard. How are you doing, Houston?
I am well. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Now, first of all, I want to talk, we're going to talk a lot about transmedia, which we're going to get into like what that is and all that fun stuff, because for people may not be familiar, but first of all, I want to talk real quick and get your input on this. So I follow a lot of different directors and filmmakers who are in the past, you know, and everything. Sure. Like Ed Wood, you know, you look at the old films of Ed Wood. And he was sort of, he would have been transmedia had it been today, you know, sure. I feel like, because, what is he had like connecting characters. He had what, Kelton the Cop, you know, right. that he had in like, was it Plan 9 and Bride of the Monster and Night of the Ghouls. And they're all sure. like connected, like the places are connected and things. But the only difference between that and actual transmedia and correct me if I'm wrong, but the big difference is that there's not other media's, you know, outputs. Like, you know, he didn't have the technology that we have today to, you know, make a CD or to, you know, to do all the comic books that we can do today or the, sure. the tools, you know. So is that what you would say?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And what he was doing, he was creating a shared universe of film, and you can have a shared universe that that all exists on one platform. But in a transmedia sense and in a transmedia model, we're basically doing the exact same thing, except we're making sure that we're not just doing single channel entertainment. We're actually extending the entertainment into multiple platforms in a way that's tactical. It's not just doing it for the sake of doing it. It's a tactical thing to expand the brand, reach new audience, and really kind of give greater breadth to the brand and the project overall. But so essentially, it's a shared universe across multiple mediums and multiple platforms. But you can have a shared universe in film and television. You can have a shared universe in just publishing. You can have a shared universe in just video games, which is cool. And I think. Shared universes are awesome. I loved, you know, I read a book series when I was in high school called The Eternal Champion series by a British author named Michael Moorcock. And it was, you know, 20 some novels that were all interconnected, but at the same time standalone. And I loved those character crossovers. You look across, you know, even as cartoons as a kid, I loved it when Batman and Robin would show up on Scooby-Doo and the Harlem Globetrotters would show up as well. And I loved those crossover events. And so the intertextuality in the shared universe is awesome. We just now want to take that to a bigger and better level by shifting that platform as in addition to creating that crossover.
Okay. Well, there you go. Because, I mean, I think that's the big difference between, like you were saying before, like transmedia as opposed to like multimedia, where sure. it's the same story. Now, I want to make sure I get this right, because this is how I explain people. Like, I think I heard you say something similar to this. And so, like, Harry Potter, you look at Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, right? And so that's a great book, right? Yep. Then you make the Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone video game, and it's the same story. Mm-hmm. So that's multimedia.
Yep.
But transmedia would be exactly. like Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and then Harry Potter and something else that happens, but they're
exactly.
a different storyline. It's just like a continued story. So
yeah, exactly. And so the traditional Hollywood franchise is built around what's called adaptation, and it's just taking the same story and repurposing the same story in multiple mediums. And when you repurpose the same story in multiple mediums, you have multimedia, which is what that traditional 80s and 90s franchise was built upon. But the modern franchise has been leaning more and more into transmedia principles insofar as making sure that video game extends the story in some way, making sure that the comic book extends the story some way. Even with straight novelizations, you know, the novelization typically is just straight adaptation, a multimedia adaptation of the book or of the movie itself into a book. But now, even with novelizations are adding new and different things to incentivize the migration of the audience. And that's why we always want to extend the story, is because the modern audiences always want new stuff. It's like modern audiences are like spoiled children. We can't get enough of everything. We always want something new. We're always crying for something new. And it's because we're surrounded with this immense, just immense options for entertainment, that we prefer new to repurposed more than the 80s and 90s audiences just had more of a limited supply. And so you know, I always point back to, I'm a big Star Wars fan, so I point back to The Last Jedi. If you watch the movie, Rey and Luke Skywalker are doing their Jedi training, and Luke Skywalker says, "I'm going to give you three lessons to become a Jedi." And in the movie, you only see two. You never see the third one because they cut it out of the film. So when they did the novelization of The Last Jedi, they marketed that whole book around the fact that now you can see all three lessons that Luke Skywalker did to Rey. When you watch The Rise of Skywalker, you know, there was so much stuff that was really kind of cut out of the movie. It felt like three movies in one. And you know, especially that early sequence that opens the film, where Kylo Ren is searching for the Wayfinder, and ultimately finds the Emperor. There's a lot of sort of montage-y scenes, and they marketed that novelization of The Rise of Skywalker around, now you actually get to spend more time with Kylo Ren as he goes to find the Wayfinder that you didn't see in the movie. So now, even with novelizations, they're really leaning into new. But yeah, that's the biggest difference between multimedia and transmedia. It seems like a semantics issue, but it's really not. It's a fundamental question of, are you telling the same story twice, or are you giving the story, or are you giving the audience something new that incentivizes them to want to check it out? I love the example of The Matrix. Matrix is one of my favorite transmedia franchises. So you had Matrix 1, then you had Matrix Reloaded. But then when they did the video game, it wasn't The Matrix Reloaded, the video game with Neo doing all the same stuff. With Enter the Matrix, the video game, now you played Ghost in Nairobi, two completely different characters on completely different adventures that didn't really focus on Neo or Morpheus or any of those guys very much at all. And so it really blazed new ground. And that's why the audience wants to check it out.
That's a great way to like look at it and everything, because I've been reading your book. I have it. I have your book right here.
Oh, look at there. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I have it like literally always next to me.
That's super
because,
cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm working on my own project, as you know. Right. So sure. I'm trying, you know, I'm doing a lot of research and everything, because I mean, it's a bigger venture, you know?
Sure, it is.
And I was actually talking to a friend of mine who is a low budget independent director, right? And a producer and everything. And he makes movies for like $5,000, $10,000, you know, and everything. Yeah. And he's okay with that, you know, right? That's his thing. And I mean, obviously I want to go a little higher, like, you know, get a bigger budget and work on something bigger. That's just me anyway. And I don't, you know, I don't look down on anybody who does go.
Yeah, sure.
Whatever, because that's all on them. I mean, my thing is I want to work on this project. So I'm working on this thing that's going to take me a little longer, you know, but the rewards are bigger, I think,
of course,
you know,
of course.
I feel like. Working on this stuff, and I've been watching your videos on Film Courage. I've been looking at these things. So I've been basically, you're kind of like, in a way, it's almost like you have a class, you know,
yeah, sure.
Like, you know, like online that we can just check out. And I think that's really cool. Now you've helped a lot of other people, like, you know, basically get their transmedia stuff going. How does that like, you know, when an independent producer, you know, comes to you and everything, what's like the first thing you tell them, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this, the big lie about transmedia is that transmedia is only for the big budget studio stuff, and that independent filmmakers need, you know, they're almost in a different category that and they don't need transmedia. I am 100% convinced and bullish on the fact that independent filmmakers, especially low budget independent filmmakers, need transmedia more than anybody, simply because they don't have the P&A budgets to cut through the noise to let people know that they even exist. And so, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, for like your buddy that you're saying makes $5,000 movies, that's awesome. The problem is, how do you as a $5,000 movie outpunch the 8,000 other things that are competing for the attention of the audience, not just in other movies, but movies, TV, video games, books, music, anything on digital and mobile? How do you fight for that attention? And that's the hard question to answer. And so when you have $5,000 movie producers, those shoestring budget movies, micro budget producers, they don't have a lot of good answers for that. They basically make their movie and then they hope and pray that the little baby Jesus will bless it and it'll somehow turn into a Paranormal Activity. And every now and then it does, like we see for Paranormal Activity, shot up for $5,000, made $750 million, whatever it was. That obviously is the vast, that's the exception rather than the rule. Most of these $5,000 independent films, they get seen by 300 people and they just kind of disappear into the night, not because of quality. And that's the tragedy of it, because some of these people are super talented and they create these amazing small budget pieces of art, and it's never seen by an audience, not because it's not good, it's because they don't have the right model in order to compete in today's world. And it's a shame. So usually when I talk to independent producers, it's getting them to understand, understand what world they're operating in. It's an education process. And just understanding, I always use the analogy. I put out a podcast last week where I used the analogy for independent filmmakers of imagine you launching a lemonade stand. And when you launch a lemonade stand, if you're the only lemonade stand in town, it's fine that you only have $10 to launch, and you don't have the best lemons, and you don't have the biggest cups or whatever it is. That's okay, because you're the only game in town. But when you go out the next day and there's 10,000 other lemonade stands in your neighborhood, all with bigger budgets, all with better lemonade, what do you do? Mm-hmm. And it's not, the answer isn't don't make lemonade anymore. Because if you're put on this planet to make lemonade, that's what you do for the rest of your life. And that's what's in your heart. But now you have to recognize that we have to approach that whole thing differently. And if independent filmmakers are fine with making movies on the weekend while they have a full-time job somewhere else, self-financing their own stuff, and they don't do it for the money, and they don't do it necessarily to have a zillion people watch it, they just do it sort of as their own hobby, then I don't push anything on them. If they're happy and they're not complaining and they're doing what they want to do, like, mazel tov, that's awesome. But typically, independent creators they care about their stories, they care about their characters, they want to do something cool and artistic, but at the same time, they want more people to see it. They want the recognition. They want to be able to propel this into a career so they don't have to make movies on the weekend while they work at Burger King during the week. And if you're one of those people, then I would say, understand the world in which we live, where we have hyper competition, a commoditized market. For the first time in human history, we have a commoditized entertainment market, which just means we have hyper competition. It's so oversaturated, and there's more entertainment. The supply of entertainment is outpaced the demand of entertainment, and that has created sort of a different market with audiences. And so my encouragement with independent filmmakers is typically, if you go through the normal pre-production, production, post-production process, distribution, add in financing in there as well. If you go through that normal process, it's going to be 2 years before your movie ever sees the light of day. And so as you're putting that, you know, it takes a long time to make a movie. As you're putting that film together, before you go to put it together, use some different platforms to attack the market, to start building your audience early, right? Because the way filmmaking has always been the model that has been built on is it's a big giant roll of the dice. You spend lots of money, lots of time, lot of effort, blood, sweat, tears to create this awesome thing, which is your movie. And then all of a sudden you go to release it and you just hope and pray that a bunch of people would all see it the same weekend so it pops. But in a hyper-competitive market, that is harder and harder to pull off, especially if you look at what we're going through with the COVID-19 crisis, that theatrical model and the film festival model can't be relied on by independent filmmakers anymore. Mm-hmm. That you can't, if independent filmmakers have all their eggs in the film festival basket, you just see how fragile that basket is at this point where we are in the world.
I was supposed to go to a film festival in Pasadena right before, you know, like everything got shut down. And yeah. I was like, damn, like that would have been my first film festival too. I was so excited for it. But
I mean, and there's 1,000 filmmakers across the country that sing the same tune, and it's tragic and it's awful. But now what do we do? So ahead of your film, if you attack the market and start building audience with some things like podcasts, short stories on Wattpad, maybe a self-published novel, start building audience. Even if you build an audience of just like 4,000 people, I'm not even talking about going viral with like 100 million people checking out your stuff. Just if you can build an audience of 4,000, 5,000 people that love your stuff, then when you create that feature film and you release that $5,000 movie into the market, now there's 5,000 people that are going to be eagerly anticipating it, which then all of a sudden makes it a more valuable experience for you. And so using transmedia to prep the market, I think, is just as important as using transmedia to then extend that franchise mm-hmm. after that film goes to extend that shelf life and give the audience more. So that's usually what I talk to filmmakers about is before you jump into the high stakes game of feature filmmaking, let's prep the market with as much content as we can, build that fan base early, and then move in to the film side.
Okay. So my next question is, can any movie be a transmedia project, like anything that somebody makes?
Sure. I mean, I think yes. I think that this is the line that you typically get from independent film. Usually it's not independent filmmakers, but it's usually independent film, you know, connoisseurs, and they love their black and white movies, and they love like the weird, like, you know, foreign film that no one's ever seen. It's sort of that sort of scene. And you say, they tell me not every film needs transmedia, Houston. Like Moonlight's a perfect film. Are you trying to tell me that Moonlight needs a first person shooter that to go along with it? And I say, listen, it may not need a first person shooter. Which kind of sounds awesome, but let's say for sake of argument, that it doesn't. That's cool. Maybe it's not a first person shooter, but maybe it's a book of poetry and a concept album that extends the story, something contextual that's in brand that really fits that vibe. I've yet to find something that can't be transmediated. And maybe it's just me and the lens that I look through, I always find jumping off points. Now, there's different kinds of transmedia, different styles of transmedia. Some don't lend themselves to the exact same opportunities as others just because the nature of the idea and the nature of the creative. But I have yet to find one thing on earth that someone has put in front of me and they say, read this book, read this script, watch this movie, play this game. And I have... And I say, you know what? Yep, there's absolutely nothing you can do. There's always something you can do to be able to extend that story. You just have to look at it through the right lens.
That's a good point, but I am now wanting you to track down the Moonlight people and see if you can get a first person shooter out of it.
That would be fantastic. I think it would be fantastic.
Yeah, I'd be down with that.
And most of that is tongue in cheek, but there's an interesting principle here, and that's this is there's a lot of teenagers out there that have never even heard of Moonlight. My nephew plays video games 14 hours a day. It's all he does, and he doesn't watch movies. The only movies that he ever watches are the big, you know, he watches the Avengers Endgame and things like that. But like, definitely never seen any independent movies or any Oscar-worthy movies, and that's just not what he does. And so the reason we shift platform is to then expose different types of people, give them an entry point into the IP, and then ultimately different kinds of people back to the movie that would never seen the movie before. And so we laugh about the first-person shooter that extends the world of Moonlight, but the fact about Moonlight, before Moonlight was nominated for an Oscar, it had made $52,000. Which is not a lot of money for a feature film. It was a drastic and dreadful financial disaster of a movie. It was a flop, and so thank God it got nominated for an Oscar, because once it got nominated for an Oscar, it made a ton of money and it got sort of the widespread acclaim that it should have. And it's not because it wasn't good. It was just a very niche, small, independent movie. And so if you extended that IP into a platform to get another audience, maybe they make more than $52,000 and they have a bigger and more vibrant audience there. But I challenge people. I challenge people, any of your listeners, any of my listeners, I challenge people, find the thing that you don't think can be transmediated. If you can find it, send it to me. And we'll see if it can. But in my eyes, I think everything can.
So I want to go back to, you were talking about video games, and one of my favorite parts in your book is the part about Assassin's Creed 3 and your nephew and your father, you know, I believe, that sure. You guys were all, you know, like, and that your suggestion to the people who made the game was to, you know, why don't you make a history book that involves these, you know, that involves all the stuff. And everything, and their response to it was, we don't know anything about making a history book. And I mean, I don't understand that myself, because I would be like, the first second somebody says that, I was like, well, that's what you pay people for, you know? Like, you say, hey, make a history book for us. And that's what I'm working on, stuff where I'm not a comic book guy, but I'm gonna be hopefully working on comic book stuff. I'll be writing comic books, and then, you know, right? And so that to me is like one of the things, like, I don't understand why people, you know, don't feel that way.
It's really interesting, and it's because people, like, all of, I think society has done this, but really the entertainment model has built around, you pick the one thing that you do and you silo yourself off, and you have this very myopic mindset about what you can do and what you're able to do. And I talked to a filmmaker who was in film school, and he actually came out of the Navy, and he was an IT specialist in the Navy, and he knew how to make apps and all these other things, and he was very proficient on the IT side of everything, but he wanted to be a director. And I was encouraging him, like, man, you need to figure out how to tap into that other skill set. Like, every movie you make, you should also do some sort of, you know, interactive website or an app or something that goes along with that. And he says, well, I thought when I became a filmmaker that I had to just do that and give up all my IT stuff. And I'm like, no. Like, that's the exact wrong thing to do. That's the way everybody kind of pushes you to, because the way our society and everything works is that we have to pick that lane and stick with it. That's the way colleges are. That's the way high school is. That's the way our moms encourage us to do, like, pick that one thing and go with it. And in today's model, we have to use all the tools in the toolbox. It's insane to me that you have a skill and a gift to use, and then you don't use that to be successful in this other thing that you have. Now, Steve Jobs calls it zooming, and he called it zooming, which is the art of connecting two dots that wouldn't necessarily typically be connected. And his degree, it wasn't in computers. He went to school and studied calligraphy, which is for real. He studied calligraphy, which seems to be the most worthless degree on earth, right? but then when he got out of school, he obviously got into the computer business. But then when he got into the computer business, you know, if you remember the computers from, you know, the 80s, they were all ugly and boxy, and there was no beauty in them at all. And he said, you know what? What if I took the art of a curve that I studied in college with calligraphy? What if I took the beauty of design? What if I took those elements and those principles from my calligraphy degree and I combined them with my what I understand about the business of computers? And he connected those two dots and ended up changing the world. George Lucas never wanted to be a filmmaker growing up. He always wanted to be an architect.
So he used architecture as like the forming of the story worlds in a way too.
100%. He went into it with the mind of an architect, and he used architectural principles to be able to construct a world for Star Wars to exist in. And like, so he went in, he wanted to be an architect when he was a kid, and he worked in his dad's toy store every summer. And so when he went into filmmaking, he went in both filmmaking with the mind of an architect and a really good understanding how toys work, and all of a sudden changed the industry that way, built a $60 billion brand, sold his company for $4.2 billion, and was so rich when he sold it, he didn't even spend the money. He gave it all away. Like that's the type of like baller status that is achievable when you combine two things that other people wouldn't combine. That's your secret weapon. That's your superpower. And so I was talking to a filmmaker, independent filmmaker in New York City, and she told me she was a painter, like a hobby painter, and also a poet. And I told her, every single movie you ever make, do a pop-up art exhibit of paintings that extend the story of your movies, and then also do a book of poetry that extends the story of your movies and your paintings. Create a little ecosystem that goes together, and all of a sudden, that not only is going to create an entry point for different kinds of audiences, so people that find your paintings and then are led back to the film, people that find the poetry are led to the paintings that lead to the film, people that find your film and then are led to the paintings and led to the poetry, not only is it going to create that ecosystem like that, but it's also going to give that filmmaker her own brand, stand out from the crowd. How many filmmakers have a brand built around being a poet and being and a painter? Not very many. So she kind of carves her own lane, which is so important in such a crowded industry.
Exactly. So I want to shift gears real quick and talk about pre-awareness, which you talk about a lot, and it's even in your book. You know, you've got a good amount about that, but what I want to know is, especially like, okay, so if you want to do, one of the things I learned from you, and I actually started implementing in my own projects, but doesn't work right now, unfortunately. And I'm gonna tell you, and we can have a discussion about this, because I'm really excited about this. Twitter. So I created Twitter characters Twitter, you know, profiles for my characters, and I had them talking to each other.
Right.
However, all of a sudden Twitter has this thing now where, you know, if you add too many people, it starts looking like spam and stuff. And even if you don't even add that many people, sometimes it even does that. It's really weird. It's not, you know, it's not a specific thing on it. So all of a sudden I was getting, you know, asked to like resubmit all these information. And I had like 5-6, actually more than that. I had like 10 characters that I already created on there. And the problem was, you can't do the same phone number for each one. Sure. So I had all these different phone numbers, and after a while it's just like, I give up, and now my accounts are suspended because I haven't done that. And I'm just like, this, like, and Twitter is making things a lot more difficult for people who are trying this stuff, who are trying to get their stuff out there a little bit more. What do you feel about that?
No, and it's right now Twitter is, since Donald Trump got elected and Russian bots and all these things that got thrust into the Twitter conversation, and misinformation being a being a relevant topic just in the world, then yes, that's become harder to do than previously thought, right? Like if you'd have done that 5 years ago, you would have gotten a lot better reach out of it. And so you have to be a lot more careful, because people don't want you you don't want to get tagged as a bot and a spam. And so I think tactically, maybe try less characters. Maybe don't go full bore all 10. Maybe and but really, I would say figure out how to take that character and actually engage authentically with other people before you start adding a zillion people. Go and start replying to other people's tweets. Go into to hashtags and reply and actually have them talk, like, maybe not talk about the story with other characters, but actually see if you can get some like organic follows. And right. And then once you get some organic follows, then people start to realize that you're not a bot. And yeah, so I would recommend that. And also understanding that over time, the tactic, you may have to switch platforms, and maybe there's more leeway on Instagram. Maybe TikTok videos are the way to go. Maybe, there's different platforms that sort of emerge at different times. Twitter is so crazy political right now, that there's all this focus on it. And so maybe take a step back and look at some other platforms to say, okay, maybe I can engage elsewhere and then circle back to Twitter once Donald Trump is finished with his presidential run.
So yeah, I agree, because like Facebook, they allow you to create fictional characters or whatever, and you can do, it's just not, it's honestly, it's not the same. I feel better, communicating with one character to another on Twitter. It made me feel like there seemed to be an easier thing, because you're going from one, I don't know, one profile to another, like very e more easily than, but I think all of those are kind of working out, and they're kind of all learning from each other. So maybe things will start getting a little easier for that kind of stuff. But then again, I like Facebook and Twitter and all of them were not made for that necessarily, So like.
And it may be that you want to hold off on that tactic, and wait until if you release more of a traditional aspect to the story early, whether that's maybe a podcast or self-published novel or something like that. And let's say there's 500 people that subscribe to your podcast. Then once they're already into the story and hooked with the story, then you release the Twitter profiles, right? And then say, hey, all you 500 folks that love my story because you follow my podcast, go follow all these characters on Twitter. And all of a sudden you have 500 organic people now following all your characters. And then you start with the story, with them engaging with each other on social media. And so maybe tactically you were that you just reshuffle when you release that aspect of the story.
That's a good point. Me and my producing partners are actually talking about that, making sure, because like not many people are aware of who these characters are, and really it does come off like spam if they're just all talking to each other and not organically chatting with other people that, like real people or whatever. So yeah, so you got to be careful, but no, that's wonderful thoughts on there. I mean, I love all your suggestions. These are little things that people can be doing right now that have
100%.
nothing, like that don't take any money,
That's
it's
it.
all free. So people are complaining, "Oh, I can't do this, I can't do that because of money." Well, now there's other options that we have. Podcasts are a great thing, very easy to do. I mean, we're doing one right now, you know what I mean? It wasn't that, it's not that hard,
Not that hard. Completely
and
free.
Yeah, completely free. And I don't understand why. I mean, people get excited when they're part of something like that. Like, I was listening to Marvel's Wolverine, The Long Night.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
freaking amazing. Like,
amazing. It's awesome.
What they're able to do, like, it just inspires me, you know, to be able to do stuff like that. And so, I mean, Marvel's got it going with transmedia. The one thing they do have the characters on Twitter, but it's all like promoting the same thing.
Religion.
And it's like, okay, I'm Captain America, I'm promoting this. I'm Iron Man, I'm promoting the same thing that Captain America is promoting. And there's no you know, like, it would be more fun if Captain America and Iron Man were communicating with each other. You know, that's what I would
100%.
You know,
I mean, Captain America's profile should have been so alive during the 4th of July weekend.
Oh my God, right?
That's such a missed opportunity, right? And what that is, that's a big studio just kind of farming out the social media to interns. They're not treating social media with the same care and concern and that they do with their comic books and their movies and things like that. But if social media is such an important, you know, it's funny because when it comes to politics, everybody's 100% certain that Russia can jump into Facebook and Twitter and completely throw and turn an American election, and that's the power of social media, that that another country can just mobilize and completely screw an election. But at the same time, they don't think it's powerful enough to really invigorate an entertainment franchise. There's a disconnect there, right? If it's so powerful that it can throw a complete election, then there is value in Captain America jumping in during 4th of July weekend and engaging an audience. And Cap is you know, it seems like his story has been finished, and at least in the MCU. But even more so to keep that character relevant now, keep him in the zeitgeist. If it's not going to be in the movies, at least give him some sort of a social media presence. So I agree, it's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but you know, then again, I mean, obviously, I don't work for Marvel, you know, but if I were the social media person, you know, in charge of that, I would have played along with it. I mean, I understand, because like, I have multiple social media accounts, and we actually had a social media intern. We have a new one. But I'm right now I'm at the point where I can do everything myself, and I'd only be telling him what to do. Right.
Sure.
Like, I would be like, oh, here, share this, when I can share that, you know.
Sure.
Like, I don't understand. Like, I'm not Disney big, Marvel big, where they have like a million different things they have to say at like every hour. They have to put out something to engage in that. You know, I'm not there yet. Hopefully one day, knock on wood, I will be. But you know, that's the thing. That as an independent producer, I look at that going, you know, yeah, that's a missed opportunity. However, you know, they're doing them, you know, maybe next year, maybe so many people will point that out to them this year that they'll go, that's a good point. Maybe 4th of July, I could, you know, say something.
100%.
Plus also, this is sort of a weird year, you know, for this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it was the best year for them to like pretty much put out Disney Plus, because that's getting so much attention. But like, other than that, like, what else, you know? Like, I mean, people are so are just stuck at home, and they're watching movies all day, you know, so they should be on social media a lot more, promoting things and getting people interested in whatever the next thing is that they're gonna already be putting out, you know.
100%. Absolutely.
So let's also shift gears real quick. I want to talk about being a transmedia producer, because the Guild actually made that a real thing, you know, because before it wasn't actually, it was just you were a producer who did transmedia projects. Now there's actual transmedia producer. I have to know, like, are you like in the guild as a transmedia producer?
I'm not, because I didn't. I just don't want to be in a union. You know, for me, once you're PGA, once you're gilded, once you're in a union, you're limited on. There's a lot of benefits come with being a part of the PGA, which is awesome. But then there's a lot of limitations as within a union, and so I. Maybe it's the libertarian inside of me that doesn't like to be controlled by a union, but yeah, like I didn't want those limitations. I want to be able to work with whoever I want to work with, without sort of being contained. Now, people that are part of the PGA, there's tremendous opportunities for them. But with the transmedia producer, I think that's an opportunity for people that can benefit from a union and that can benefit from a guild. I'm very active inside the PGA. I'm a PGA mentor. I speak at PGA workshops and events, and I do a lot of education within the PGA. I just choose not to be part of the guild myself.
Yeah. So, but the I guess the new deal is that you have to have produced a transmedia project that has had three medias, you know,
three basically. Stories and three mediums, yeah, all set in one narrative universe. Yes.
So just like, I mean, that's transmedia in general, right? Anyway, right? Like that's
they put an artificial number on the number three. But you can, I think, you know, philosophically you can be transmedia, which is two. It's just you're not going to get PGA credit for it, or you can do 17 things, which are all set in the same narrative universe, all linked together, and that's transmedia as well. But yeah, they wanted to try to codify some sort of mechanism that professionals could lean into as far for industry credit. Now, one of the things that I think is a shortfall is that this pertains to me probably as well as I know a lot of other people. A lot of people just work on sort of the development side of transmedia, the writing side of transmedia, and that they don't actually produce anything. They sort of create the world and they create the map and they create the stories and they write all the stuff and then they hand it off to production teams that go and actually produce the material. Mm-hmm. And so what one thing that I've been really pushing for in the past couple of years is for there to be a Writers Guild credit for transmedia, just like there is a Producers Guild credit, and so that even if you don't actually physically produce the material, if you write it, then you should be able to get credit as well.
Wow, that would be good.
Really fantastic.
Yeah, it would be fantastic because I feel like, I don't know, maybe it's. You know, it is a lot of Hollywood thing, but like the writers generally get, you know, the least credit period of anything, you know?
Yeah.
And they're the ones who are like creating the story world. They're the ones who are out there making these things into something even much, you know, bigger than what the producers are doing. The producers are just putting it together, and without them, like without any of all these different things, you know, project would get off the ground. But you know, looking at it going, you know, the writer is basically the god of everything, you know, like he's the one who created it, you know.
And in TV and television right now in Hollywood, television is the only place where writers reign supreme. In feature films, in video games, it's the writers are very much the not the low man on the totem pole, but especially in feature films, the directors are king. You know, in video games, the programmers are king. And so TV still has that place for writers where they can, that's their own little fiefdom. But other than that, I think writers, you know, usually writers are the introverts and they're fine with it. And they're just back holed up in their dark room, kind of pounding out the pages. And they're not the sort of gregarious as the directors and things like that. So they're typically fine with it. But I think there, especially people in transmedia that want to focus on the narrative side, there should be some sort of mechanism, I think, in credit, industry credit for that as well.
Exactly. Yeah, I like that idea of the writers who are holed up in the, you know, stuff. I guess I'm sort of like, I always tell people I'm an ambivert, you know.
Okay.
You know what that is, right? A lot of people don't, you know. I tell them that and they're like, what the hell is that? And I'm like, I mean, it's basically an introvert and an extrovert together, but it's true. Like, you know, I can be out at a Hollywood party as long as I'm with people I know, you know, and I can feel fine, but I'd rather, you know, if I don't, after a bit, I would be like, no, I'm just going to go home and I can go home and be by myself. And I'm completely fine with that too. You know, like it doesn't matter to me as long as, you know, I'm happy in that moment. And I feel like a lot of writers are introverts. They really do like to be by themselves and they're like happiest when they're, you know, writing and everything. Yeah. And if you're not, if you are a writer who's like, who hates it, because I hear about all these writers who hates writing, and I'm like, I could never do that. Like, I could never do something, like, force myself to do something I didn't enjoy doing. You know, that's just me. You know, especially if this isn't a job yet. Like, this isn't a professional gig yet. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just doing this for spec, you know, or whatever.
Of course.
But, yeah, it makes no sense. Like, I'm sure you feel the same way.
100%. No, I agree. And there are, you know, I would say to somebody who's a writer that hates to write, my question is, would be whether you're a writer at all. Right. You may have a skill in writing, but that doesn't mean you're a writer at like intrinsically. And so my encouragement and the reason that when I say, are you a writer at all? That's not a pejorative. That's not a dig. That is, let's do some self-inventory and be self-aware to say I have a skill set in one thing, but that's not really me. And then that creates the opportunity for them to find out exactly what they are. And it may be that they're writing the wrong types of things, or listen, it may be that they've just been gifted with a skill of writing, but they actually want to play music, or they actually, you know, want to be a dentist or whatever it is. And so, so I think finding that thing that my grandpa always says, once you find a job you love, you'll never work again, because it doesn't feel like work. And there's some old like country grandpa wisdom in there. So that would be my encouragement to those writers that find themselves into that situation, for sure.
Well, that goes back to the whole lemonade stand thing, you know, of like, you know, what if you were made to make sell lemonade, then you're, you know, made to sell lemonade. Don't give up on it because it's not working out. Keep going at it, you know. I don't understand the people that just quit. Like, I wanted to quit. I've told this story to a few people before, but I almost wanted to quit back in like 2010, that was when I was first starting out, you know.
Sure.
Shit was getting like hard for me at times of doing this, like these short films, and I was just like,
sure,
I'm not enjoying this at all. And I was at a horror convention, and a friend of mine was like, what's the matter with you, what are you know, right? And I was like, I think I want to quit. And she said, well, what are you gonna do? And I was like, I don't know, just be a writer. Because I wanted, you know, I was doing filmmaking, producing and stuff and everything. And I was like, just be a writer, you know, because like writing something and sending it to people and then them asking me to send back, you know what I mean? Like, that's simple, right? All the other stuff, being a producer and getting all the, you know, getting everybody together and then, you know, making sure things actually happen, you know, like that stuff's hard, you know, like, I'm actually pretty good at like, introducing people to other people and helping, you know, create a group of people, you know, I'm like, I'm pretty good at that. So, you know, and that's the only reason I haven't quit producing is because I'm okay at that, you know, or whatever, enough where like people like it. But, you know, I would rather be a writer, you know, when, like, isn't that just, it seemed like the easier job to do?
Well, it seems like it. I mean, obviously, you know, as a writer, I mean, writing is very, to write well, is very difficult. And, it takes a lot of patience. It takes a thick skin, for rejection. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there is an attraction to being a writer. not just for the fact that you get to create and design sort of the narrative and all that and make the characters come alive, but there is always sort of this romanticism about, you know, living the life of Hemingway, and just like being out on a boat and by yourself and just writing whatever you want. Like there's something cool with that. But you know, you talk to writers and being a writer, you know, everything is equally as hard in different ways. I don't think there's one sort of magic bullet, easy way out for anything. It's just, it's easy. It's easier for people that are designed for that. You know, the way machines work is if a machine is designed to do one job, and you're making it do a different job, it's always going to put stress on that machine. It's doing something it's not designed to do. And people are the exact same way. When we're designed to be a producer and we try to force ourselves to write, it's going to be hard. When we're a writer and we try to force ourselves to produce, it's going to be hard. And but when we go back to writing, it feels easier. Does that mean writing's easier? No, writing's easier for that person. Because you're using the machine the way it's intended to be used.
Exactly. No, I like that. You know, yeah, you got to figure out what you're designed to do necessarily. And that's like, you know, like I know I'm not happy if I'm not like writing something at some point, you know, or whatever. Like when I take breaks and everything, I get angry and everything. Yeah. And I'm like, I need to write, you know, that, you know, is when you are a writer, you know?
Absolutely. Yep.
And so I feel like that's when people find that, you know, they should hold on to that, you know, as long as they can.
Absolutely. You
know, and everything. 100%.
100%.
So let's talk about intellectual properties, you know, real quick. I do want to know, like, how do you secure intellectual properties, for yourself or for like, you know, adaptations or whatever, especially on the indie level?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just you need to reach out to the rights holders, and if you're looking to license something or option something, it's really just sending a query letter to the license to the rights holders, and usually that, you know, that can be kind of sussed out through some good Googling, you know, because if you find a book that you want to turn into a movie, or you find a short story you would love to kind of riff off of, you should reach out to people and say, hey, I'd love to do this. This is my vision for it. And, you know, most of the times there is some sort of fee that goes along with that, a license fee. And the licensing game and the option game is very competitive and very expensive. But it's doable even for an indie producer. It's just the problem is, if it's something quasi known, there's probably already 10 other producers already hit up that same person and are probably offering larger amounts of money that you can pay. Right. And so that's the hard part. And so the only way that you can then do it is hit them with a vision that is so inspiring and meaningful that they decide to walk away from their payday to be able to work with you, which is rare. Or just try to like really find that diamond in the rough that nobody else has identified, which is also rare. But it's a hard game to identify and secure IP and IP rights, which is why I always encourage people to go into the public domain. And, you know, 70 years after the death of the author, intellectual property moves into the public domain, which it means it's not protected by copyright law anymore, which means it's free game for anybody. So The Wizard of Oz is a great example of that. Like anybody, you can make a Wizard of Oz movie. I can make a Wizard of Oz movie. Somebody else can make a Wizard of Oz comic book. We never have to pay Frank Baum anything because it's in the public domain.
We don't, but here's something interesting I learned. A guy I know actually made a Wizard of Oz movie, right? And he said that he had to be very, very careful on certain things. He had to stick to the book, the original book.
The book is what's in the public domain.
Right.
The Yellow Brick Road and the Ruby Slippers are things that MGM put into the film.
Exactly.
To show off their Technicolor technology. And so, yeah, if you do a Wizard of Oz thing with the Yellow Brick Road, you're going to get sued. You would get a cease and desist letter. But what's cool is there's different ways around that. There's a cartoon on Amazon that that's a Wizard of Oz cartoon, has a cool steampunk kind of vibe to it, and they don't have the Yellow Brick Road. It's a subway called the Yellow Line. and the yellow line goes right into the Emerald City. So it's not it's different enough not to get sued, but at the same time, sort of gives the nod to what we all know as the Yellow Brick Road. So there's different ways around that, but yeah, you're right. You have to be careful about what is and isn't in the public domain.
Well, I'm just glad I learned that stuff because, like, you know, you look at one of the most, like, you know, things is Dracula, right? And I'm working on Dracula. I mean, the thing is, I don't think Universal owns, like, specific things on Dracula. Like, they don't own – there's no, like, the cape isn't specifically or the fangs, you know what I mean? So there's really nothing – you can do Dracula anyway. And there's been a million Dracula movies, period, like – that existed. And all of them are different. Like, I was watching that Dracula, NBC Dracula, and I was laughing because it feels okay. There's NBC Dracula, and Dracula had Renfield, and Renfield was a black man. And I felt like, this is going into like sort of it, like saying, isn't Renfield like a slave? And he was his assistant, but I was like, that's a little touchy, you know, like I would not have touched that at all. I never would have done that because that's just, that's almost like, you know, I understand it. But then again, I'm like, I would not have, I don't know. Would you have said that was a good idea for them to kind of have Renfield be black and be the assistant of, you know, him?
Well, I haven't seen it. You know, with all those situations, you got to be super careful, and you have to be empathetic, and you have to, you know, I would get opinions from diverse mentors and advisors, and understand how that makes other people feel, because at the same time you want representation, but at the same time, if you use representation in a way that creates a harmful allusion to something else, that can be destructive. And so it's tough for me to say without specifically seeing that. But that's always sort of it's an important conversation. It's a tough conversation to have. It really just depends on the situation and what you're trying to get out of it. And, you know, and also where that character goes and how that develops, I think plays into it as well. But right now, that's a dicey issue. So
yeah, and this was a few years ago, I think, that they did it, and I think, I mean, obviously they did it because they were wanting to put more, you know, African American actors into pivotal roles, right? Sure. However, I was like thinking of all the roles, like making Dracula black has been done with Blackula, but that was like a joke kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Charity thing. Making it real, you know, that would have been a cool thing. However, making, you know, Renfield, who's the assistant slash basically he's his slave in the stories, you know, it was a dicey issue. Watching it, he is an assistant, and he's more like, you know, a friend to Dracula. You know, he's not like this, you know, mindless character or whatever. That was just like, when I heard it, I was like, oh, I need to watch this to like
see if
that's how they were handling it or how they handled it.
Sure. I mean, you have to handle it well. Yeah, you have to be aware of the times and you have to be sensitive in the execution of it. It's a tough one, right? I mean, it honestly it is. And I know there is a video game with a Battlefield video game that was knocked for representation because it was a World War I movie and all the characters were, you know, white males. And they tried to add in you know, African American characters, female characters, to create some diversity and some representation. But you know, then it's almost a historical, and like I get it. It's just a hard nut to crack, and I think you want to err on this. I mean, obviously, err on the side of representation. You know, I mean, you have to look at, you know, what does, you know, put it like what 1400s or 1500s Romania. Like, you know, what was the demographic make of that, up of that? Would he actually have been the assistant of Vlad Dracula in that thing, in that context? I don't know. But I think if you err on the side of representation, that's better in today's market than just adhering to the historicity of it. So I don't know. It's a tough call, but I think if you approach any of those situations with empathy and kindness and compassion, and you should usually and get the opinions of other people, you should be able to land in the right determination.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you. I like that. We're going to have to close in a second, but I do want to say thank you so much, Houston, for this, because I think this is awesome talk, you know. And I tried to make sure that I tried to do ones that you haven't talked about, you know, ask questions
sure.
that probably haven't been asked yet about stuff. Maybe we'll get you on again at some point. And to do some more stuff, especially once I start actually really diving into the transmedia world, I would love to, you know, have you back on and chat. Is there anything that you're working on right now? Like, what are you up to?
Yeah. So right now, me and my team are working on a really awesome time travel project, which called The Speed of Time, which we're really excited about. And so that's actively in development. We have a project right now that delves into untold stories in Black history, Black American history in particular. That's awesome. And then during quarantine, we've really been doubling down on digital content. We have a podcast called the Super Story Podcast, where that's been awesome and been fruitful. We've been using the Zoom platform just like we're doing today, to be able to leverage podcast content. And then at the same time, we also have a vidcast on YouTube, and called the Super Story Vidcast, which is the video version of the podcast. And getting ready to embark on writing my first novel. So I've been a screenwriter for so long, going to start, putting my hands to my first novel, which should be super fun. So staying busy during quarantine, trying to maximize that time, and not letting, you know, I think looking back on quarantine, I think there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be regretful of like, oh man, I had 5 months at home and I didn't flip that into something, right?
Right.
I don't want to be one of those guys. So I'm trying to stay as busy as possible. It's been cool. It's been fun. So I'm doing a lot of speaking engagements as well. So that's been awesome too.
That's great, dude. I love everything that you've been doing and all the help that you've been telling people about this stuff, because it really gets the word out about it, but also sort of helps, you know, people like me who are just kind of just trying to figure this out, you know,
sure.
like just trying to figure out where I want to go to next and stuff. So I just want to thank you. If you stick around for a second, I did want to ask you one personal question and then,
sure.
you know, but thank you so much. And everybody, I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast. Okay. Bye.
All right.